Welcome everyone to Leaders in Business and Investing. Today I'm joined by a true legend in the investment community, Mr. Joe Greenblatt. Mr. Greenblatt is founder and co-CIO of Gotham Asset Management and co-founder of Success Academy Charter System in New York. Mr. Joe was also the professor for acting faculty of Columbia Business School for over two decades. His new book, Common Sense, An Investor's Guide to Equality, Opportunity and Growth, which he discusses inequalities in the education system, taxation and immigration reforms, is available, the link below. I'd highly suggest getting a copy for yourself. It's a truly insightful read. So Joe Greenblatt, thank you for coming to the show, sir. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Sure.
So to begin with, I would like to know the title Common Sense conspicuously shares its name with Mr. Thomas Paine's classic. What is the parallel that you wish to draw with Mr. Paine's work? And what is the change that you would like to inspire through the book?
Sure. So Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense in 1776. Really was one, according to George Washington, one of the main impetuses to the revolution and one of the main supports that Washington gives it credit for. And the interesting thing about this is that the book didn't really focus as much on, you know, taxation without representation or property rights. It really goes to the core of the matter, and it starts off this way. Who picked this king guy anyway? It's like Paine got off a boat from Mars, starting from the very beginning, saying, you know, forget about, you know, the issues of the day. Why should we even be listening to this king? So it really starts at a very early point in the discussion. And so I bring up topics that if you really stand back more than 40,000 feet, but maybe viewed them from Mars, these things are, these issues can maybe be looked at in a little different way. And so I took that vantage from far away saying, is this right even from the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You approach social and political issues from a very unique perspective of a value investor. And what inspired you to take on these issues given your background as an investor?
Sure, well, there are the topics in the book really struck me. I'm a long-term investor, not just a value investor. I'm a long-term investor. That's how having patience and looking at the long-term effects of what you do today, what is the payoff over a long period of time? And, you know, so much of what we try to solve is solving it immediately. And the investment decisions we make in people, particularly, is based on, you know, what the payoff is right away rather than the long-term payoff. So I think it was just a little different way of seeing some problems that, you know, I'm a capitalist. I believe in the capitalist system, but there are some things that just seem wrong to me from the very beginning. And these were topics that just stood out for me. And I thought adding another perspective, one that a long-term investor would take, might add something to the conversation.
Wonderful. And in the book, you emphasize that improving on the American education system is the first meaningful step to long-term change, improving the living standards of lower middle class and middle class. And as both as a professor and a leader in the New York charter system, what inspired you to become so involved with education?
Education is pretty straightforward, you know, just the old cliche, teach a man to fish, is fish for a lifetime. If you're looking for the most leveraged way to help people, it's to give them the tools to help themselves during the course of their life. And education is an obvious place to start. So, you know, in investing, if you're successful, you probably get paid more than what you're contributing to society. So if you're successful, I always ask my students at the beginning of the year to, you know, I'm teaching them something that I've always enjoyed, but if you really examine the social value, you're probably overpaid for your skill set and what you contribute to society. So I just asked them to think of a way to give back. And one of the first ways that came to me when I was trying to think of those things was education. And if you really look at things, in the top 50 urban centers in this country, if you are Black, Hispanic, low income, minority, your chance of graduating college is 1 out of 11. And we know that a college graduate makes 70% more than a high school graduate. and a high school graduate makes 30% more than a dropout. So if only one out of 11 are making it through our system to a high paying job in our urban centers, if you are one of those disadvantaged groups, stepping back for a second, how can that be? How can that be fair? How can that be a fair system? So I think, capitalism is a good system, but it has to be implemented well. And if people don't have the tools to take advantage of it, it becomes unfair. And the way our education system is set up in this country is pretty much the most unfair system. It's all set up based on where you live. So the only people who don't have choice in our system are people without means. Anybody who's middle class or has any amount of money, they'll choose the neighborhood they live based on where the schools are. And if you don't like your neighborhood, you have the wherewithal to move or send your kids to private school. The only people who don't have educational choice are lower income people who don't have any choice of where they live, and they only have the local schools. And so I got involved in the charter school movement to provide more choice for people who don't have choice otherwise.
And what steps would you suggest will allow us to reinforce the quality of education, and what can policyholders or even general public at large can do to maybe improve the situation at least somewhat?
Right. So I talk about what the issues are in the book, and talk about it really from what can we do based on what we have. And I talk about the impediments in the current system. And I talk about how charter schools giving a choice, these are just independently run schools outside the normal district, how I'm involved with a charter school, but there are many good ones. And we have 20,000 kids in 46 schools. And if you took them all together, the kids, which are the vast majority are low income and minority, outperform the wealthiest school districts, every single wealthy school district in New York. So those 20,000 kids outperform the kids from Scarsdale and Great Neck. I also talk about good district schools. I talk about one district school, which has a great principal, Jack Spatola. And in his school, 99% of the kids pass the math test and 94 pass the English test. He's in one of the lowest income neighborhoods in Brooklyn. But the thing about those statistics I just gave you, the 99% and the 94%, those were for his students with disabilities. Meaning his students with disabilities, 99% were passing and 94% were passing the English. And if you look across the regular district schools, kids without disabilities were under 40%. So they did more than twice as well. And these are kids with disabilities compared to kids without disabilities. I also showed English language learners at his school, 90% passed the English exam. They're English language learners, where if you're an English language learner in a regular district school, 10% pass. So his pass rate is actually 9% pass. So his pass rate is 10 times better. So I said the kids can do it. There are real examples across 20,000 kids in charter and from good district schools. I picked out one great one, but it shows that with the right supports, almost every kid with disabilities, without disabilities, English language learners, not English language learners, can achieve at very high levels. And then the question is, what can you do with that information? The information that the kids can actually do it with the right supports. How can they have opportunity, yet only one out of 11 are making it through college to get a high-paying job? So what I suggest in the book is something called alternative certification. And to cut to the chase, what that really means is, let's say you want to get a job at Microsoft. What I suggest Microsoft do is lay out which courses, which certificates, which tests can people, if you want to get a job in the HR department or the accounting department at Microsoft, all they have to do, they don't have to give tests, they don't have to make tests. All they have to do is set a standard to say, if you can pass this test, pass this course, get the certificate, if you can do these things, we will consider you for a high paying job in the accounting department, HR department, or whatever, and they would set standards for each department. And then what I suggest, and I go through a lot of data to show how it's been done in other areas, a whole ecosystem will be created. Once the prize is there, there's a buyer now for people who pass these tests or courses. Once there's a buyer, then a whole ecosystem will set up of supportive tutoring services, supporting online services, charitable services, community services that will set up to help students pass these courses. And if you came from a disadvantaged background where you did not have a great education, I also suggest that there'll be a list of prerequisites that courses that you could take that will be developed, this ecosystem, so that you get ready to take the next exam up, being ready to get this exam. So I go through how it's been done in other places, and basically it's just like a low-cost diploma, an alternative certification. We're not making it through our current system. It's $1 trillion a year. If you go through kindergarten through university, it's $1 trillion system. It's very hard to disrupt the system. And I talk about, when I ask my students, you know, what strategy would you use to beat Tiger Woods? And this was when he was at the top of his game. My suggestion was, don't play him in golf. You know, how can you work around the current system? The current system isn't working for 10 out of 11 low-income minority kids. How can you work around the system to give them this opportunity? And all these courses and tests can be rated like Uber drivers and Airbnb rentals. You don't need government involvement. You don't need government money. You just need these major companies, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, JP Morgan, to set standards to get a high-paying job in various departments. And they'll have to do research to find out what works best, and they'll have to iterate over time. But just setting up that prize, and then I go through all the math of how it's important to have a diverse workforce, and how there's a lot of data to show that that's better for these companies. Plus, all these companies are under pressure, you know, because they're potentially monopolies, because they're under pressure to do social good, because they don't hire a diverse group. This is a great way to do that for them as well.
It's a wonderful alternative. And expanding on that, we've seen the global economy becoming increasingly more global over time. And that has sort of created an increased competitive pressure for wages across workers across the world. Typically in the United States, we see that it's probably the worst affected because of the labor costs differences that exist. And you proposed, first of all, income tax, earned income tax credits as a way to sort of incentivize people to join the workforce and maybe contribute in that manner. But you also, and it has worked, as you mentioned, lifted millions out of poverty. You also proposed going more aggressive on it. So could you expand a little bit more on as to how, why it has worked? And why would going more aggressive on this front would be something we can look into?
Sure. So we have a program that's the third biggest social welfare program in the United States. It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And what that says is, we know over the last 20 years, a lot of high-paying manufacturing jobs have gone overseas or been disrupted by technology. And so people are taking much lower-paying jobs. The long-term solution is education and job training so that you can get a higher paying job. But this disruption always happens. In 1900, 40% of the people worked on farms. Now it's less than 2%. So this is always happening, but it's happening a lot quicker than it's ever happened. And so there are a lot of people who have been disrupted. A lot of people don't have the time or the money to pursue education or more training. And so the question is, can you get everyone to make $15 or $20 an hour? And the problem with minimum wages are that if you're contributing only $8 an hour to a business, they can't pay you $15 to $20 an hour. So we have something called an earned income tax credit that, from the government, that makes up the difference. And we spent, in 2018 anyway, the data I had is $68 billion on it. Took 6 million kids out of childhood poverty. It did great things. It's a great program. There was a study out of the University of Chicago, which showed that when you take into account the extra employment taxes from people getting money from the earned income tax credit, that $68 billion, sales taxes, lower social welfare costs because you're giving them money here, the net cost of that $68 billion was closer to $9 billion. And in addition, even with the earned income tax credit, there was a study done at Washington University that said the cost of childhood poverty today runs us $1 trillion a year. And that's really due to poor childhood health care, poor education, crime, incarceration, homelessness, social service costs. These are all costs that we're already incurring. They add up to $1 trillion a year. And what I suggest in the book is that we could raise the earned income tax credit from $68 billion a year, what it would take to get everyone earning $15 to $20 minimum would be about $1 trillion a year. Now, of course, that wouldn't solve childhood poverty, but the actual cost due to more employment taxes, sales taxes, lower social welfare costs, you know, from the University of Chicago study, that $1 trillion would really only net cost us $600 billion. We would probably incur less than half of the $1 trillion a year in social welfare costs for kids in poverty, childhood poverty. So we'd make up $500 billion there, and we'd get $200 billion back from adult medical care. So it, I go through the math and show how it'd be less than free to increase this policy from $68 billion to $1 trillion. Then I suggest we're not going to do that so quickly, but the case for raising the $68 billion, tripling it to $200 billion, I go through the math of that, and that's also incredible, and it gets us to triple a great program. So it's a great program. I think we can easily triple it. I showed how we could bring it up 15 times and make money. If you're a long-term investor thinking about the long-term payoffs and what you cure in childhood poverty and who you take out of it, this program is less than free. So at $1 trillion, it's less than free. Certainly at $200 billion, you get the lower hanging fruit. It's gonna be less than free. And so as a first step, I'd settle for tripling the program. I go through the math. It's incredibly compelling. If you're a long-term investor and thinking about the long-term payoffs here, they're incredible. And I just wanted people to focus on it. It's a great program. We should expand it.
Yep. Cool. And to expand, you also talk about U.S. not being particularly, I would say, welcoming to immigrants. It's second last in terms of modern nations when it comes to welcoming skilled immigrants even. And you point out the fact that skilled immigrants adds millions of dollars in tax revenue and also creates employment for U.S. citizens. Then, well, you also point out the inefficiencies in the H-1B visa system. How do you think we can address that? And why do you think it's the case that it's so complicated the way it's set up right now?
Right, so I think we all know, it's a good question. We all know that immigration is a controversial topic. So I address one portion of immigration, which is really a no-brainer in my mind anyway, which is skilled immigration, which is we actively discourage skilled immigration out of developed nations. We come in second to last to Japan in welcoming skilled immigrants. Japan actively discourages immigration. To go to Japan, you pretty much have to speak Japanese. In the United States, we should have a big advantage because the language of business and science is English. That's our language. Second to last is embarrassing in welcoming, especially because some of the facts you mentioned. For each skilled immigrant we take in, the net value in today's dollars that we take in from the government services they receive, less the taxes, we collect from them. We make $500,000 to $1 million on each one we bring in. We also create almost two jobs here. two high-paying jobs here for each immigrant, skilled immigrant that we take in. Bill Gates was quoted that at Microsoft, because I guess the skill of the immigrant, the skilled immigrants they're taking in is so high, it's each skilled immigrant they hire, they hire four more people, natives, you know, people who are living here. Mm-hmm. So they create four jobs for people already living here. So I just point out it's a free gold mine. You know, everybody you take in that's a skilled immigrant. Some of the stats are incredible. Immigrants founded 51% of U.S. startups with over $1 billion in value. Skilled immigrants are immigrants in general, twice as likely to start a business as natives. They're responsible for a quarter of productivity growth over the last 20 years. Immigrants or their children have founded 216 out of the 500 Fortune 500 companies. That's pretty incredible. Our H-1B program is, our cap is exceeded within the first few days by five times. Yep. So we're not letting enough people in. I suggest a very simple fix. I suggest that we can take all the skilled immigrants that we want. If an employer, we have a much better program. If you want to go to Canada or Australia, they have an unlimited skilled immigrant program. You pass these government standards on education or other skills, okay? Mm-hmm. They let you in automatically. I actually argue we have a better system. We have an employer-based system for our H-1B, where only if an employer wants to hire you will you come in. So it's a one-to-one perfect match. Just because you met some government criteria doesn't mean you're ambitious, doesn't mean you're hardworking, doesn't mean you're a good fit for a job. But if an employer wants to hire you, that's a one-to-one perfect fit. If they're willing to pay you at least $60,000 or $70,000, I propose, that speaks to your skill. If they're willing to pay a 20% tax on top of your salary to the government for 5 years until you can get a green card, you know, I suggest you qualify for a green card if you keep that job for 5 years, or any job where an employee is willing to pay you a 20% premium. We can take that money for and use it for job training here, education here. We can use it for a lot of things. But that will arguably be cheaper than our current H-1B program. We'll take unlimited skilled immigrants. No one's going to hire a skilled immigrant over someone who's already living here because you have to pay the 20% premium. If you can find someone qualified, they'll hire them here. So we make it completely unlimited. We'll create all kinds of jobs. We'll create all kinds of net money. And the only problem with what I'm arguing is that we have the Statue of Liberty say, give me your tired, your poor, meaning we want to help refugees that, you know, want a better life here. We want to help people who want to come here or are unskilled. For every one or two skilled immigrants we take in, we can take 8 or 10 more unskilled immigrants here. They cost us money. But it's something that we should do. It's part of the strengths of our, you know, the diversity is part of the strengths of our nation. Mm-hmm. And we can take 8 or 10 unskilled immigrants if that's what we want to do. We can take 8 or 10 kids that are already here out of childhood poverty with the money that, you know, for one or two immigrants, we can take 8 or 2 skilled immigrants. We can take 8 or 10 out of childhood poverty. I don't want to get in the argument of which is the better thing to do, taking more unskilled immigrants or help the kids who are already here. I would just say, let's take the free money from taking the unskilled immigrants and then decide the great things we can do with that money. You know, companies that don't have lack of opportunity, don't have political freedom, people don't feel they're safe. They have a brain drain. The best and the brightest want to leave. The United States is the first choice of immigrants from around the world. Second choice is Germany. Four times more people want to come to the United States than Germany, and Germany's second place. So there's huge demand from outside to come here. The skilled immigrants bring us so much money and jobs. Mm-hmm. I suggest that it's a free gold mine that we're blowing and that we should do this right away. And I think all of Silicon Valley would agree with me. Mm-hmm. And a lot of businesses of all kinds want those skilled, talented people to help them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful way to put it. I mean, given the general perception we have on immigration, moving on to the inherent risk in the financial systems, we saw that in 2008, insurance companies and banks and some of the hedge funds and mutual funds as well, they're all sort of interlinked to each other in a way that makes them sort of one falls, it brings everybody else down with it. And you suggest that there's a way to make banks, specifically safer. And, you know, can you expand a little bit more on that? And how can we avoid competition among banks from them being incentivized wrongly to, you know, reduce their standards when they're lending out?
Sure. So that's a good question. I mean, we all saw what happened in the 2008 crisis. Mm-hmm. And since that time, we've had Dodd-Frank, we've had a lot of regulatory reform. And I'd say in general, all for the better. But if there are costs to all those regulations, small banks are disappearing. There are no new charter applications for new banks. Why? Because all this regulation is very expensive. So it does almost the opposite of what we wanted. It helps the large banks because they can afford it, and the small banks disappear. With them disappear small business loans. Loans under $1 million, business loans under $1 million are down 75% since 2008. We know business formation is way down. We need those small banks, arguably, for that. We also haven't solved too big to fail. A study out of the Minneapolis Fed said that we still have a 2 out of 3 chance of having another banking crisis in the next century, even with all the protections that we put in. So I tell the story at the beginning of this chapter about how England used to send their prisoners in the late 18th century, early 19th century, on a ship to Australia. And one of the earliest voyages, 40% of the prisoners died along the way from disease and malnutrition, things of that nature, which is obviously a horrific outcome and caused a lot of outrage. So of course you can solve that with more regulations covering medical care, or, you know, what kind of food, other safety requirements, cleanliness, more government monitors on board the ship. You can do a lot of regulation to make sure that doesn't happen again. Another way to attack the problem, though, is to change the incentives for the ship captains from the beginning. They were paid for the people, each person who boarded the ship in England. But if you change the incentive to pay captains for who got to Australia alive and well, and penalize for people who didn't make it, you're now setting the incentives up correctly, and the ship captains then are able to figure out how to do that. I'm not saying you don't do a little of both, but what I'm saying is setting the incentives up from the beginning goes a long way without having to hyper-manage the situation. And I suggest the same type of solution for banks. One of the problems with banks are that to get deposits, if you pay more, you get more deposits. If you lend at lower rates, you make more loans. If you lend with easier terms, you make more loans. Money is fungible, so that it's inherently competitive business, both on the deposit-taking side and on the lending side. It's very competitive, so people compete. A lot of times they compete in the same industries and get into trouble at the same time. But it's just, and it's very leveraged. It's wired to get into trouble, is the way I put it, the banking business. So one way, if you're thinking of the Australian prisoners solution, is to set the incentives up correctly from the beginning. And what I suggest that might involve is more equity. Rather than less than 10% equity, even though it's increased significantly and the risk controls have increased and everything else, still 2 out of 3 chance that we haven't solved too big to fail, according to the Minneapolis Fed. So what I suggest is more equity upfront. So instead of less than 10%, 20 or 30%. And before all the bankers start screaming, what I suggest is that that additional 10 or 20% equity be created with a new form of equity, preferred equity, that is tax advantage. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is this 10 or 20% extra equity cushion for banks would be tax deductible. The dividends would be tax deductible to the bank, tax free to the owner of the preferred security. So in other words, it's going to be subsidized, tax subsidized by the government upfront. We're already subsidizing because we're inherently the backstop. We're too big to fail already. So I'm really moving the incentives up front so we don't run into that problem. If you have 20 or 30%, what I suggest in the book is that when a restaurant fails, the economy doesn't skip a beat. When a large bank fails, it starts a cascade. They're all so intertwined, it really makes a big difference. So if you have 30% equity, then the equity holders will lose that money. It'll become like the restaurant. It won't be the government having to bail you out with your thin slice of equity gone. Equity holders, whether they're preferred or common, are always losing money. That's just the way the system works. You pays your money, you takes your chances. I suggest from an incentive standpoint to align the incentives correctly is that as far as the board is concerned and as far as management options are concerned, assume that the common equity and the preferred equity are stapled together and you get compensated based on the performance of that combined, those two securities combined, so that everyone is incented on the management side and on the board side to maximize the combined value of the preferred and the common. Okay. And that should prevent a lot of the regulations that have really hurt the small banks, have hurt the small businesses. It also solves too big to fail. It's very simple. Now we do, since Dodd-Frank, we have a way of subordinated debt being converted into equity. But there are a lot of scholars and, you know, some Fed officials who believe we'll never kick that subordinated debt in and convert it to equity because it'll start a cascade effect amongst other banks being worried about being converted as well. And so what we have now, if it ever did, you did flip the switch for a large bank to take some of their debt, their subordinated debt, and convert it to equity, that would also cause a systemic problem. So I don't think it would actually happen. And that's why with preferred, we wouldn't even have to worry about that. So that's my suggested solution or some version of that. And, you know, I'm excited about it. I've gotten some good feedback on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You also talk about the advantage of starting early, leveraging the power of compounding for investors. And related to that, you also talk about Australia's superannuation policy compared to our Social Security here in the U.S. How do you think those two things tie together and one can augment the other? And what drawbacks do you see in Social Security that can be addressed?
Sure. So if you make less than $12 an hour, which is, you know, 40 plus percent of hourly workers, you make in the low 20s a year, your Social Security is pretty close to about $9,000 a year. So very hard to live on that. Mm-hmm. So that's our savings program now. But nearly half of working age families have zero retirement savings. The median family, age 32 to 61, have about $5,000 in retirement savings, basically nothing. The average age, low income, Black, Hispanic, or non-college graduate have no retirement savings at all. So they're left with Social Security. I'm not saying Social Security is bad. I'm saying it's not very generous. 9 in 10 families in the top fifth income quintile have a retirement savings. 9 in 10 in the bottom quintile have no retirement savings. So it's a very unequal system. I tell the story that when I taught a bunch of ninth graders, the first thing I did for them was put a compound interest, compound investing schedule on the top of their notebooks. And I gave this one example. And I said, if you start saving at age 19, $2,000 a year and save for 7 years, you put in $2,000 a year and then never put in again. So you put in from 19 to age 26, 7 contributions, never put in again. Or You start at age 26 and put in 40 contributions. Both investors earn 10% a year, which has been the average of the S&P for the last 50 years. Both investors earn 10% a year. One put in 7 payments and then never put in again. One started at age 26, 7 years later, and put in 40 payments. The investor that started earlier with only 7 payments ends up earning more, $930,000 versus less than $900,000 for the one who put in 40 payments. The point being that starting early is the key. And of course, when you start, you don't have a lot of money. You're not earning a lot of money. Low income workers never have a lot of money. So they don't have money to put away. So the people who need it the most to take advantage, the big advantage of compound interest as a society, we're completely blowing it. So what can we do to supplement the savings to take advantage of compound interest? In Australia, they have something called superannuation, where people, instead of Social Security, have savings accounts. And then they have another program that if it doesn't end up being enough, it supplements that at the end. Social Security is very popular. We're not getting rid of it. We're not going to go to a private savings account like Australia. But what I suggest is we also do a hybrid system. We keep Social Security as the base. Right now, Social Security is really based on how much you put in is related to how much you take out. Since how much you get out of Social Security is capped, we also capped in at last year $137,000 when you stop contributing to Social Security as a high earner. You don't contribute anything above 137 to the Social Security, okay? Because you stop getting benefits from it. So what I suggest is that, one of the suggestions I make is that we lift that cap, not to raise taxes, but if you're a high earner earning $400,000, $1 million or whatever, you keep paying your Social Security contribution above 137,000. But 80% of what you collect from, you know, above 137,000, you get to put in your own 401k like account. The other 20% that goes directly to low earners and young people to set up their own 401ks to take advantage of compounding. Okay. And that's going to be a lot of money for them because the high earners earn a big chunk. You know, people are aware of the inequality of income as well. And so this high earners will mean a lot of money for younger workers, for low income workers in a 401k that can take advantage of compounding for many, many years. Right now, they don't have the money to put in. This is what I would do with that money. And it's just one suggestion, but the main thing I wanted to do was say, hey, compounding is the biggest thing we have to help people with no retirement savings. We're blowing it. We're not using it. Social Security isn't enough. How can we supplement it? So people need to know about this. This is a looming crisis that's just going to keep getting worse.
Absolutely. Yep. I mean, it's especially compounding. I think so few people really understand how it really works over time. I think it's really a terrific idea, complementing it like that. Moving on to investing and the markets. So with the elections fast approaching, a lot of policy decisions on the line, how much do you think the political climate in the near future will impact investors? Because you talk about being a long-term investor, being a value-based investor, markets being irrational in the short run. Do you think depending on who gets elected and what the policies would be, especially in terms of taxation, would that have a tangible long-term impact on the economy?
Yeah, I think we should have good tax policies. It's, you know, once again, we have to think long-term. You know, right now we're in the middle of, as we're talking, we're in the middle of COVID. And when you think about the values of businesses, people ask me, you know, well, what do you think is going to happen? And the way we value businesses really based on what normalized earnings will be a few years from now, and then how much is that going to grow over time. That's 90% of the value of a business. What happens over the next year or two is a very small portion of the value of a business. So whether, as horrible as it is, so the pandemic lasts and another 3, 6, or 9 months is not the big picture for valuation of businesses. Tax policies have been known to change over time. So if I'm thinking about the market, I think on one hand, a more normal, you know, if the Democrats were to win, and it depends what happens in the House, and I mean, what happens in the Senate, you know, whether it's a split government or not, I think the market would probably like that the best, so that there has to be a compromise reached when, you know, changing any policy. Apart from that, what the Democrats would probably bring is a more normal way of, more predictable way of looking at the world. I think the Republican policies have been very pro-business, taxes, formation of businesses, formation of jobs, all those things. So I think there's some advantages to that as well. I'm hoping that whatever we come up with bridges those two gaps. You know, we're all familiar with the issues of inequality. The question is, how do you solve them? What I wrote about in the book anyway, were solutions that I think both Democrats and Republicans could embrace, because it's long-term investing that will grow the economy, not just redistribution. And so I think it depends what are the tax issues, you know, what are the tax policies that come out? Very hard to predict. It could go either way because, you know, in some of the high tax states like New York and California and Illinois, you know, getting rid of the SALT deduction was a big deal for those states.
Yeah.
If that's reintroduced a deduction for that, even with higher tax rates, you'd have to weigh for those states which way it would go better. So I think it gets a little complicated. I think there's pros to both. Me personally, I think if we have a more middle of the road solutions and more predictable for businesses and individuals would be better for the economy, but I can't really opine on where we're going to go on that. But I hope we end up somewhere in the middle.
Wonderful. We've also seen, especially over the last decade, hedge funds, especially long short hedge funds, typically have underperformed the indexes, and this has happened for a long time. How much would you attribute that to the rock bottom interest rates over the last decade, propping up asset prices artificially? And do you think, especially something like value investing, where you need intrinsic values and market values to coincide at some point in time to book your returns, do you think that's going to make a comeback? Because it's been out of favor for a long time. And like in general, what do you see over the next decade in terms of returns?
Okay, so a few questions in that question. I guess what I would say is when the market goes straight up, hedge funds, which by definition hedge, are going to be challenged. I think long short hedge funds have been particularly challenged over the last 5 years. As the market has just gone straight up, I think last year the statistics are, if you know, because of COVID, produced some issues right with earnings in the second quarter of 2020. But if you go back and look at the 2000 largest companies and you bought the 261 companies that lost money in 2019, so forget about COVID. If you bought everything that lost money, you would be up 65% through the end of September. So just buy every, so that's your strategy, buy every company that loses money. So what I would say is some of the larger companies like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, in general, that's not where the froth is. Those are great businesses like we've never seen. We own a lot of them. I think those are justified. I don't believe there are hundreds of companies that justify the valuations that are given to Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. And so I think there is froth in some section of the market, which I think has hurt long short funds. So I'll make that observation. The second part about value investing is it really depends how you define value investing. We do not define value investing as low price book, low price sales investing. We define it as figuring out what a business is worth and paying a lot less. And that's really based on cash flows and how much those cash flows are going to grow. You know, Warren Buffett said, you know, growth and value are tied at the hip. Growth is a component of value. So if you're thinking of the traditional definition of value that Russell would use or Morningstar, I don't have a real opinion on whether value will come back. My inclination is out of favor companies will come back, because companies that aren't earning a lot of money, some of them will be very successful, but not hundreds. And therefore, I think there is some froth in the market in that area. And that may come down, may help the traditional definition of value. But we're like private equity investors. We value businesses based on cash flows and try to buy them at a discount. So that definition of value should never go out of date or out of popularity, right? If you are good at valuing a business, that's what stocks are. That's what stock ownership is. You own a share of a business. So if you're good at valuing a business, like a private equity firm buying the whole business would, and you can buy it at a discount and you're good at valuing it, then the market will eventually reward you. I make that promise to my students every year, that if they do good valuation work, the market will agree with them. I just never tell them when. Could be a few months, could be a few years. So that type of value investing will not go out of favor. As far as low price book, low price sales, I can't opine on it. My guess is that it's been a little too much wave away from it. The underperformance of value over the last 5 years has been even bigger than it was in the 5 years before the top of the internet bubble. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're parallel, and there was a big switch there, but I do think it won't continue as it's been, if you're asking an opinion. But my real opinion is I don't care. Our definition of value is quite a bit different than low price book, low price sales investor. There's no private equity investor is going to go buy a business because it's low price book. And that's the way we look at it. So we wouldn't do momentum either. If I came to you with a real estate strategy that said, hey, I'm just going to buy all the houses that went up the most in the last 3 months, you'd look at me a little funny. You'd say, I don't want to give that person money. That doesn't make much sense to me. And that's how we kind of view it. Yes, it has worked very well for 30, 40 years over long periods of time. But it's pretty easy to emulate a high momentum strategy. It could get crowded, degraded. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, if you value businesses and try to buy them at a discount, that shouldn't go out of favor.
Wonderful. And you talk about growth being part of the valuation, obviously. How do you typically, because we've seen traditional value investors looking at book value, net liquidation type investing, that has been out of favor. And how do you typically inculcate growth? Do you look at industry growth rates? Do you look at penetration rates, diffusion rates? How much do you weight against what earnings yield are you getting in any of your investments?
It's a little simpler than that. I mean, we have a fund called Gotham Enhanced S&P 500. And the way we look at it is we buy all 500 stocks in the S&P 500. And if we think something is undervalued, we'll buy a little more of it, the limit tracking error. If we think it's overvalued, we'll buy a little less of it than what's in the index. Why would we buy a little more of it? Well, because if the index has a certain, expected earnings a few years from now and a certain growth rate, and we think we're going to earn more relative to the price we're paying, and it's going to grow faster, we'll overweight it. And if it's going to be less, we'll do less. It's that kind of simplicity. And of course, you can take that as extreme as you want, just buying the cheap things, taking large positions in those, and taking short positions in the ones that are most expensive based on that kind of analysis. So, it's a very difficult world because rates are very low. There's not another game in town. Luckily, our businesses, people give us money and say, put it in the stock market. Mm-hmm. So we're not really deciding, should we be 30% long or 100% long? They give us their stock market money and we're buying the cheapest things we can find out of the choices that we have. So I know I'm punting on your question, but that's what we do. And that's how we look at it. So there's always something that's cheapest. And it's a combination of absolutely cheap and relatively cheap, to all our choices and similar companies. And that's how we go about valuing businesses.
Sure. For my last question, I would just like to ask you, so we have 30% less public companies than we had a decade ago. We have almost 10,000 hedge and mutual funds looking at those 3,700 listed stocks in U.S. market. Where do you see the industries headed in terms of, it's really competitive, probably the most competitive industry in the world, probably. And would you suggest investors look to maybe emerging markets, some of the less penetrated, less competitive markets in search of alpha? Or do you still think U.S. market should, it is still a great place to be?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, on the less amount of stocks, as a percentage of GDP, they actually have a higher market value. So there are less stocks, but they have a higher market value in total than they did before. So there is enough to invest in as far as amount of market value, total market values has gone up at a pretty good clip, even though there are less individual companies, you know, down from 8 or 10,000 down to 3,700. So not worried about that. I do explain to my students, you know, they ask the same question. And, you know, isn't the party over for us? Effectively, congratulations on your great 37-year career, but, you know, we're going out there now. Isn't the party over for us? And so I take them back and I say, let's take a look at the most followed market in the world. As we know, you just described as the United States. We'll look at the most followed stocks within that market. That would be the S&P 500 stocks. And let's go back to 1997, you know, 20 or so years ago, and see what's happened. So I explained to them that from 97 to 2000, the S&P 500 doubled. From 2000 to 2002, it halved. From 2002 to 2007, it doubled. From 2007 to 2009, it halved. From 2009 to today, it's, you know, more than tripled. My way of saying that people are still people, they're quite emotional. If you believe what Ben Graham said, that this horizontal line is fair value, and this wavy line around that horizontal line are stock prices. With the markets doubling and halving, market doubling and halving every few years, well, that doesn't even begin to tell the story, because that's an average of 500 stocks. If you actually lift up the covers and look at the individual names within those 500 stocks, I gave you the doubling and halving was for the average of 500 stocks. The ride is much wilder on an individual stock basis. People are still very emotional. I think we'll still have a lot of opportunity. You know, here's the horizontal line when stocks are too low to buy them, too high to sell them. I think we have that opportunity. We just saw this year, you know, market fell 35%, now, you know, made it all back, you know, within 6 months. So, you know, we still have volatility, we still have emotion. So we still have that opportunity. Of course, I agree with you. The more off the beaten path you can look, whether from individual stocks or in other countries, which aren't as closely followed, or situations that aren't as closely followed, I've always been a big proponent of that. I think it's a great place to look. But I still think there's opportunity here, and I think there's opportunity elsewhere. And so, as Ben Graham would call it, an enterprising investor still has lots of opportunity. There is more competition, but there's also more short-termism, meaning people are being viewed and their returns are being viewed over very short time periods. Mm-hmm. And they all try to make money in the next few months or few years. I still think the opportunity is in time arbitrage, being a more patient investor than everybody else. And I think that's getting better. So, and I think this move to indexing, which I think is a right move for many people, is getting pretty strong. That also leaves opportunity for active stock pickers. So it's bad for the active management business. It's really good for stock pickers. And so that would be the positive note I would leave you with. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Joe Greenblatt. It was a pleasure to have you on the show, sir. And for all our viewers, his new book, Common Sense, An Investor's Guide to Equality, Opportunity and Growth, is now available. Links will be available in the description below. And I would like to thank our guest, Mr. Joe Greenblatt, one last time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. See you next time.